Hey everyone, welcome back to Citywide Blackout, your home for music, movies, and more. I'm your host, Max Bowen. In this episode, author R.B. Wood takes us to New Orleans for his book, Bayou Whispers. We talk about the story behind the story and his own experience in New Orleans, both before and after Hurricane Katrina. He gives us an in-depth look at the characters and the roles they play in the story. We also look at the lengthy world building that took place and research that RB did to prepare for the writing process. He is the author of the new book, Bayou Whispers, a thriller horror story that I am absolutely loving. I am talking to writer RB Wood. Welcome to the show, man. It is great to have you here.
Man, thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Oh, dude, so am I. I have been checking out the book. I am absolutely digging it. And I'm going to start off by giving you guys a quick run-through as to what happens. So this is the story of Janine LaRue, the sole survivor of her family after the devastation brought on by Hurricane Katrina. Following this, she thought she was saved. And, of course, that is not what happens. She's held hostage, sexually exploited, and eventually rescued by a sheriff's deputy by the name of Curtis Jones. Fast forward 12 years later, Janine is an attorney in New York, and Curtis is a crime boss. What a shift. And Janine finds a lot about her family that she didn't quite know about. And trust me, folks, it gets dark really fast. RB, I have a million questions about this book, but I want to start by asking about the novel writing process itself, because I believe this is your first novel. You've done a lot of short stories over the years. What did you find were some of the issues you encountered going from, you know, short pieces to a full-length novel?
Well, I actually indie published a novel back in 2012 called The Prodigal's Fool, and this is a completely different process now. 5 years ago, I had a series of pretty serious health problems, one of which was about 30 strokes, 30, that's correct. When I realized I couldn't do my day job anymore, it was recommended to me by family and some physical therapy people that I get back into and doing more of the writing, which I love. I always love telling stories. I wanted to see if I could still write a novel, to be perfectly honest. And I wanted to do it seriously. So I went back and I took courses at Emerson and I ended up with an MFA in 2019. And Bayou Whispers ended up being my thesis project. And I sold it this past year to Crystal Lake Publishing, who said, listen, I don't know you, but I love the book, so I'm buying it. And that's where we are today. So my process is a lot different than it was. I mean, I would do a very, very sketchy scaffolding outline and then just let the process unfold. That turns out to be not a good process for a longer work. For a short story, that'll be fine. I did a pretty detailed outline for this book. It was probably 20, 22 pages long. And there are a lot of nuances, and you're reading it now, so you'll see them. There are a lot of nuances, and there's a lot of moving pieces. The problem is I got to know the characters so well, they said, no, don't make it the Southern Gothic that you planned it. Make this a thriller. Make it go fast. We need a shot clock, because that needs to put pressure on us. So the bad guys in this, you know, there's a voodoo priest who's in competition with Curtis, is the crime boss of the area. And he's known as Papa Nightmare. And he's not the only bad guy. The other bad guy, of course, is the shot clock that goes and ticks until the last page. So there was a lot of work with regard to putting the outline together. I went, fortunately, just before the pandemic, I went back down to New Orleans. I spent a lot of time there when I was consulting back in the 90s and the early aughts. Can we say aughts now? Does that make me sound old? Maybe that makes me sound too old. But anyway, I wanted to go back down and see and talk to people and see about the changes since Katrina. And I'm glad I did, because it was the last trip I took before we all ended up locked in our houses and with Corona. But the interesting thing is, while I outlined and plotted a Southern Gothic horror novel, direct, nothing else going on, it morphed over time as I got to know the characters, and it became this survivor story for Janine, right? Her arc and all the characters, even the minor ones, have arcs in the novel, and it's so important that you have that mapped out, because when they align, you know it's right. You know the whole process is right. But Janine's story is a survival story. I mean, as a teenager, she went through Katrina, which is horrible enough. She lost her family. That's horrible. What happens after her, which is hinted at and discussed, but is not shown, because I don't think that would have been just gratuitous. And as a teenager, all of these things happen to her, and then more happens to her throughout the story, until she finally takes control of her life and who she is and all the rest of that. And I think that part is what made it clear to me it was a survival story. And I realized I was going through my own therapy after what happened to me 5 years ago for this survival story. So, you know, it worked out in way more ways than just a finished novel. It's been a labor of love, is the old trope and cliche, but I'll use it here. It was a labor of love. And now the rest of the world can read it, and I can't wait to hear people's feedback on the book.
The fact that this became so personal for you, that it was so therapeutic for you to, you know, after what you had gone through, were you sad when it ended?
No, you know, that's a great question though. I wasn't sad when it ended. I was elated when it ended, because I felt so much better personally. And, you know, then I had a piece of writing that I was pretty proud of. You know, it's the best I possibly could make it. And I was extremely happy with how it turned out and how I felt after it. There was a sense of relief, and it wasn't a relief because I finished this undertaking. It was a relief, like a weight was off my shoulders, because I got the story out, and I relived a lot of what I went through the lens of this attorney, New York and now back in New Orleans attorney. You know, it's therapeutic. I felt great after it was done. And I don't know if a lot of writers feel that way, but boy, it was, I could practically float. That's how I felt when it was finished, and it had nothing to do with the fact that the writing was over.
I think that a lot of writers might feel the same way, because they just spent all this time in this own world that they created. Mm-hmm. And it's such like a wonderful experience. Let's talk about your main character, Janine LaRue. How mm-hmm. do you get into the mind of a teenage girl who's been the victim of sexual assault? How do you kind of relate with that kind of character?
Yet another fabulous question. I had this image in my head of somebody who's going to become an extremely strong person. All the women in my life that I dealt with, you know, from my grandmothers on both my mother and father's side, to my mother, to my sister, to my wife, to even my daughter, who I was just on the phone with a couple minutes ago, the strong women. These are strong, strong individuals. You know, things might phase them, but they come back twice as strong, and you better not piss them off, right? And you speak to a lot of people when you're mapping out a character. And a lot of times the people that you've met, you know, you speak to, imprint partially or at least in subtle ways to that particular character. Now, there was a friend of my wife's and mine, my wife Tina and I, her name was Janine, where I got the name Janine from. Now, this is a woman who was sports and very physically active, young woman in her 30s. So this was a few years ago. And she ended up being diagnosed with colon cancer and given 6 months to live. Well, she lived 3 years. And that was intestinal fortitude. And she worked up until the end, because that's what she loved to do. You know, there's a lot of strength behind that. You also speak to people, you know, that my guess is any normal male who chats with males and females alike, the females that you chat with a good percentage of them will have a story, maybe not as horrific as Janine's, but will have a story about sexual assault or inappropriate behavior. And, you know, the Me Too movement was a fantastic result of the Trump presidency, quite frankly. You know, I'd like to make sure that and see that that continues. It's a problem. And when I have a daughter who's 20 years old, and I don't want her to go through that. But I spoke with and have known women who have. And it's heartbreaking and heart-wrenching, especially the parts when nobody's believing them or nobody's listening to them, et cetera. What kicks off the action in the book, as you know, is the fact that the two people who found her and assaulted her for a period of time are found dead, and they're found with Curtis Jones's gun at the crime scene. And it starts off as a murder mystery and becomes way, way so much more. So how do you do that? You listen a lot. You talk to people. You know, you need to do that sort of research to get into that mindset. It's not a pleasant mindset. Even though you know there's a light at the end of the tunnel for this particular character, those darker aspects of the writing sometimes will take a toll. And I had to walk away from the book for a couple of days after writing, because I initially wrote the preface, which is her being rescued by Curtis. I initially wrote the whole scene of Katrina and through that. I had to walk away from it because it was dark, but you know, it has a basis in fact. People have gone through these sort of problems and these sort of issues. I like to highlight that. And I like to make sure that people are talking about it, because the more people talk about it, maybe the less it will happen.
How do you create a character, though, that will continue the Me Too conversation without it sounding like a PSA, without it sounding like you're kind of bashing the lesson over the reader's head?
Well, that comes down to the realistic characters. I love creating characters for my stories that are real people. You know, there's good and bad in everybody. And you know, people go throughout their day, and then you throw something strange at them and see how they react. And that's Janine LaRue, right? There's a woman who went through a lot of crap, crawled out from the muck, literally, to become a well-respected, young, brilliant attorney. And I think if the characters are given an arc and you're honest about the portrayal, and it's not a PSA because you resolve a lot of the issues you bring up, that's how you do it, and that's how you tell the story. And it would be wonderful if my book was a catalyst to have some of those conversations, because there's race discussions in the book as well. And that is, we have Black Lives Matter, and people are talking about it now. They should have been talking about it hundreds of years ago. And things need to change in our society. And fortunately, we have a society that can be changed by the people who live in it. And that is a very unique opportunity for the people in our country to change some things around for the better for everyone. That's a part of what writers do. It's going to be really interesting to get a catalog of everything that had came out during the Trump administration and during this pandemic, just to see how people dealt with it. I mean, if you read some of the literature from the 80s when Ronald Reagan was in office, Handmaid's Tale, Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, and things along those lines, boy, did they predict what happened to us in 2016. Like spot on scary predictions. And I think you're going to see some similar stories coming out of that. Just imagine the stories that are going to be written by people who are in internment camps, separated from their parents and things along those lines. As long as you're telling a story that is true to who you are as a person, who the characters you've developed are, and is entertaining, but also gets a message across, then you don't have to worry about the PSA issue. And I can wax poetic on this like all night long, dude. So if you want to take a smoke break at any time, you feel free or something along those lines.
Oh, hey, I am all for continuing the conversation. That leads to another question, though. Do you feel that artists have almost this responsibility to continue the conversation in their works?
There are some writers who take that message to heart, and that's what they write. And they write papers on that. They write nonfiction about that. They write their fiction, which is very heavily messaged. And then there's someone like me who likes to balance entertainment and the message. I mean, a story should have a message to it. I believe that there's a more, you know, morality tales from the old Grimm's fairy tales and things along those lines. There should be a message or a series of messages, but it shouldn't take away from the entertainment, because what you want to do is you want people to read it. There's a reason why people who read more tend to be more empathetic, and it's because they're experiencing multiple lives, multiple people's emotions, multiple people's woes and triumphs and failures, and you become more empathetic as a person. How can you not? Because you're learning more and more about emotions and situations that are different than the ones that maybe you grew up with.
Speaking of entertaining, let's talk about Curtis Jones, who is quickly becoming my favorite character. The way that we are introduced to this character is following him first being Janine. He's on the run from the cops in his muscle car doing like 100 miles in a rainstorm. And he's having the time of his life. And yep. Even when he crashes the car, he's like, no worries. I got this. I loved his character. But how does he change personality-wise when he goes from cop to crime boss?
Well, you see how that transition happens later. There is flashbacks in the book. And I know a lot of people don't like flashbacks, but I like the exposition of showing different scenes and how things come about. And you find out how he, and he's railroaded. And what you find out is that there are, and there's a reason why, by the way, I've set this in the fictional parish of St. Dismas. St. Dismas, by the way, is if you know anything about your Christianity, was the thief on the cross next to Christ who asked for forgiveness. So it's the repentant thief. So there's a little thematic aspect to that. But he is just railroaded, and he makes the best of it by turning to a life of crime. And he smuggles stolen goods and things along those lines. But you find out that, like I said, everybody's got gray areas. There's a reason why he's a protagonist and not an antagonist in this, and some of the police he dealt with in the past and still deal with today, fictional police, are not the best of people in the world either. And that plays out to some degree in the book as well. And things happen to people in life, and where you expect to be after you're 18, you go to college, or you go into the military, or you do both, or what have you, where you end up at age 50, as opposed to where you are at age 18, usually is someplace completely different. I've always loved telling stories, and I always knew I would write and tell some stories and things along those lines. I never thought that would be something that would be my calling, if you will, much later in life, but here I am.
I definitely saw him as like a Patrick Swayze kind of character.
Sam Elliott is, but you're spot on. Just because Sam Elliott was older than Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse, so, you're spot on there. And he'll do more things to make you think that way as well.
I like that. You talked about how he's more of a protagonist than an antagonist. Without giving a whole lot of spoilers, though, what role does he play in the book? Is he sort of a guidepost for Janine?
He was certainly a mentor to her when she was younger. Part of the journey is a bit of a role reversal, and I won't say any more than that.
Good call. I like that. All right, then. Let us move on to setting. But I imagine mm-hmm. this had so much research involved. I imagine you're, mm-hmm. I imagine that your like internet search history is replete with all kinds of random stuff, like any good writer. What did you know going into this, and what did you have to dive into to become familiar with it?
Well, I knew a lot about New Orleans when I started the book. Like I said, I did a lot of consulting. What we used to do as consultants is we'd show up at a client midday Monday, work till midday Thursday. And, you know, we'd work through the night and all the rest of this. And I was a lot younger then. And then we would leave midday Thursday on a Southwest Airlines flight to New Orleans. And then we'd have Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then early morning Monday in New Orleans. And then we'd go back to work. And I did this for years, me and the a few people here and there that would join me. I love the city. There's no other place in this country that you can have such an amazing music, such amazing food, such amazing people, and such amazing history, all from the bar seat or while you're strolling down Bourbon Street or St. Charles or any place or St. Louis or any place else. It's a very unique place. And I can't think of a city in this country that over the last couple of decades has gone through more in the way of disasters than New Orleans. You know, Katrina was 2005, right? So what better place to set what becomes a survival story than New Orleans? And I use some of the history, as you'll find out a little bit later in the book, or you've seen in the book. I'm not sure exactly how far you're into it, but I do use some of the history, much to the chagrin of some of the protagonists in this. And, you know, it's a unique place that, you know, there's a feeling that you get when you're there, and it's a thrum. And I don't know how to describe it other than to say it's a powerful, deep sense of time and people have passed through the, you know, over these cobblestones and around these areas and through the Mississippi and all the rest of it. And you just have to respect that. I mean, I lived in Europe for 5 years and, you know, you walk around Dublin and, oh, look, there's a part of the original Dublinia wall. That's 2,000 years old. And you're used to that. In this country, there aren't a lot of things older than, you know, Boston, Philadelphia, and things along those lines from a Western culture perspective that's still around. But New Orleans has that history. And you know, the Spanish were there, the French were there. You know, horrific things happen there, amazing things happen there. And it all comes together in an amalgam of just deep cultural experience.
What was it like seeing it after the hurricane hit?
I was actually down there after Katrina hit, and that was it. That was just awful. Just awful. I mean, I had an old cell phone with me at the time. And so the pictures that I took aren't great, but I went down there to help out as a lot of people did, because our government at the time wasn't doing that. In fact, Venezuela and Cuba were the first people to come or offer to come to the aid of the people of New Orleans. Here's an interesting little factoid. I was in a bar off of Bourbon Street. That's not the unusual part. Here comes the unusual and interesting part. I spoke to some people in the bar, and almost every person in the bar, male and female, had a fleur-de-lis, which is the symbol that you see on the helmets for the saints and et cetera, which has both good and bad connotations with it. And when I asked why there were so many of those tattoos, anybody who was in New Orleans and survived had tattooed that on themselves as a way to say, hey, I survived this and I'm going to continue to survive. And that had a huge impact on me. You know, we say mark time before Christ and after death or, you know, whatever the Latin phrase is, it escapes me at the moment. They mark time before and after Katrina. They really do down in New Orleans. That's how devastating that entire storm was to the region. You know, they were talking about completely abandoning New Orleans at one point after the storm. And certainly I think the population has now recovered, but a lot of people didn't go back after what had happened. But they're thriving now. And these people stayed, and they made the best of it, made a life for themselves, and good on them. You got to be impressed with that.
Oh, yes. And anyone who can survive that and come back, and in any kind of city that can survive this, recover, and thrive now, that's an amazing quality. What about learning about voodoo and Haitian religion? That must have been so much fun to dive into.
It is. I study religions because I find it fascinating. I am agnostic myself for the most part, but I find religions are fascinating and people's belief systems are fascinating to me. And when you write religion, you know, you have to be respectful. That's, you know, Prodigal's Fool, my first book, delves into a lot of some of the Catholic religion and hierarchy. Diving into voodoo and Haitian voodoo and what's become voodoo, I wanted to do it justice, but I also wanted people to know how bad Papa Nightmare was and just his actions there in the book, as you'll see and as people will read. Hopefully, please go out and buy it. I need to buy more coffee for myself. Yeah, man. There's probably still 6 or 7 voodoo books in my basement office here. The rest of them are out in the library, out on the other side of the wall here. There's a lot of reading that goes on, and if you like religion and you like historical stories and things like that, you're going to be doing research all the time. You should see the amount of research I'm doing for the next book.
How long did you spend world building this thing before you started writing it?
6 months. I spent 6 months developing. Well, that also developed the outline, right? Because you know, I love working, as I told you, I love working on characters and creating these characters. And once they begin to talk to me, then I know I've reached that saturation point. But there's more to this story than just this story, because I tie it to the first novel that I have with a very Marvel-esque, in a very Marvel-esque way, right? Like Tony Stark, Robert Downey Jr. showing up in The Incredible Hulk, or Samuel L. Jackson showing up at the end of the first Iron Man saying, "I am Iron Man. Have you heard about the Avengers Initiative?" And I've got something else. I have something like that brewing long-term. But the amount of world building I continue to do is significant. I think I probably have 150 pages of just world building facts, magic systems in the worlds that I've created. And being respectful for religions, but also tying it back to a magic system that you've created is a very unique challenge. But as a writer, you need to challenge yourself. You can't just keep writing the same thing over and over again. That's boring.
Oh, God, yeah. God, yeah. Talking about respect for the religion and research, of course, voodoo and Haitian religion, it's replete in movies and books and TV shows. Mm-hmm. But what are some of the biggest misconceptions that folks have sort of learned about these new concepts from the mediums?
Well, I think it's easy to point to voodoo as something that is a mystical anomaly and maybe evil in nature. And it's not by any stretch of the imagination. There are certain elements, and like any religion, there are darker elements and lighter elements. And I think you need to be respectful and show that through your characters. You know, the characters in the book have a lot of respect for the power behind the magic, not for the guy wielding it. And that's Papa Nightmare. And it's important when you're writing about something like voodoo or some of the old Hindi practices, especially when it comes to worshiping the dead and things along those lines, to be respectful of the belief. And if there's a character, a good character, that's fine. If there's a bad character, make sure you delineate between the belief system and the character. And if you do a good job of that, not saying I did, I hope I did, but if you do a good job of that, the respectfulness should be there. And people should hopefully learn a couple of new things about voodoo in this.
I certainly hope so, because I feel like it has been, like you said, made into this like evil magic society, and it's just not.
Yes.
It's like, it's really, it's just a religion. It's a faith. It's not good or evil. It just is.
If you think about the Salem witch trials, right, back in the 1600s, how did we get to a point where 400 some odd years later, where, you know, there are people who still go, oh, witches, that's bad. And they don't have a problem with the people who burned them. Right? I find that people who are Wiccan, for example, are some of the sweetest, most gentle people I've ever met in my entire life. You know, and it's like Islam. You know, America, Islam is bad. No, it's one of the sweetest religions out there. Yes, there are fundamentalists who take it to an extreme place. But you know what? Christianity has that too. It's called the KKK. Right? So the KKK are bad. Christians, for the most part, are good if they actually live to the ideals that were exuded by Christ. But that's a conversation for a whole other time. That's what you have to kind of bring forward is what is the core belief system and what's behind that and what overall is touted by that. I mean, you know, they even had devil worshipers, people who worship Satan and Lucifer were handing out food and things along those lines during the pandemic when stuff was bad. Well, okay. They're actually doing something good. Why are they doing that? They're not recruiting people. They're just realized that it's not being done enough and it needs to be done. And that's what intrigues me about faith systems. It's not the bad, the evil aspects that everybody likes to highlight, because you need to have conflict in your books and your movies and your TV. But you can do that without disparaging an ethnicity, a religion, or a race, or anything along those lines. You can do that, and it's a little tougher to do, but it's much more satisfying when you achieve it.
Absolutely. Now, Papa Nightmare, I think that is one of the best villain names I've heard in quite some time. Now where I am in the book, we are just being introduced to him. Janine is in a cab. So all of a sudden, the cabbie turns around, no eyes, and says that like Papa Nightmare is coming for her. I visualized that in my head. I was like, holy shit, that's terrifying. Papa Nightmare, though, what is he?
He is a person. He's a person who likes earthly trappings, which means he uses his power to benefit himself, which is exactly the wrong way that you need to think about voodoo. And he is, as I mentioned, he's in competition with Curtis for the regional distribution of stolen goods. You know, he's all about the making money and greed, right? It comes down to that's what he's about. The cabbie, who, by the way, you do see later, Easy Street, is an unfortunate victim of that sort of selfish behavior. And that's all I can say about that.
And that's it.
Dude, we got to have a conversation after you finished it.
Exactly. Read the book, everyone. Go read the book. Now, you mentioned earlier working with Crystal Lake Publishing, and I've talked to a few different writers who have worked with them over the years. How did you find them, and what was the benefit of that relationship?
I found them a few years ago, specifically because people I knew had published with them, and I have had their books, and I was impressed with the quality. This is a smaller press, but they've got a really good sense of what they like, what they don't like in stories. And I've liked their stories on a regular basis, especially their anthologies. So I got connected with Joe Maynard, who's the CEO of Crystal Lake Publishing. I connected with him through Todd Kiesling, who did my launch party. And we spoke, and he had an open call for novels when this one was done. And I went, you know what? I was looking for at the time I was looking for an agent and maybe publish it with a bigger house. Let me go play with Crystal Lake. Let me see if what I'm hearing about with how nice and how professional Joe and the team are, et cetera, are the truth. And my experience with them has been fantastic. You know, they listen to their artists. They take ideas. The cover that I have for Bio Whispers was drawn by an artist that I'd engaged with. And I brought it to Joe and I said, look, and here it is. And here's how it goes, matches with the story. And he said, I'll use it. I'll take it. And it's a collaborative process. And Joe loves to teach people the back end sides of the business, you know, the marketing, the PR, how the process actually works. And you're heavily involved with the entire process from once you get the acceptance to the edits, the revisions, anything that's requested. You know, he'll make suggestions. You can take them or not take them. And you have a great dialogue. If debate wasn't such a negative sounding word, I'd say it's debated and it's spoken about. You know, it's like rhetoric. Rhetoric now brings to mind politics and just BS coming out of politicians' mouths. And that's not what the word rhetoric means, right? But the collaborative process, you know, he's a good guy. He was at the launch party doing stuff in the background for me with regard to the questions. Now, the man is 6 hours ahead of us. No, 6 or 7 hours ahead of us. You know, we had it at 8 o'clock. So it's like 3, 4 in the morning for him. He was there for me. That's the type of boss you want. That's the type of guy you want at your publishing house, who's not going to forget you and who's working with you. In fact, he did a deal with another organization to he liked the book so much, he's bringing out an audio version of it, you know, in the near future. I don't have a date yet, but he liked it and he said, I was going to sign and wait until I see some other books that come in. But you know what? I like this so much. I'm signing you right now if you want, which was great. And I got connected to him through networking, and you do the networking through the conventions and interacting with folks on social media. Horror writers are the nicest people. You would never believe that, but they're the nicest people. And writers who are further along in their career than I am have played a huge role in encouraging me and giving me feedback on things that I'm not doing right and showing me what I am doing right. And they're just, I want to get to a point where now people will come to me and ask me for some advice, just to give back to the community that has been so helpful for me to get started.
You're very right. Horror writers are the nicest guys. I know several, and I think there's this image of this kind of like creepy, evil person, but nah, they're super nice. I think it's kind of like metal bands and punk bands. You might think they're like hard edge people. No, super nice, super friendly. You bring up advice, and I think that's a really key thing. What would you have for someone who's sort of diving into their first book, but is a little unsure about what to do with it or if it's even worth the time to write?
Well, so I'll always say it's always worth the time to write, and you should read twice as much as you write. So you should be reading all the time, and that's how you get better at the craft. You see how somebody else does things, and you go, wow, I want to see if I can do that, and that would work for a story that I have. Deciding on whether a story is good enough, it's a very personal journey. And I could certainly advise people how I would view a story that they propose or pitched me and say, what do you think? But in my case, the story that becomes a novel is the story that's in my head and won't go away. And won't go away until I start writing it. And then it becomes more intense until I have actually finished writing it. And I've got two stories right now fighting in my brain for next dibs. There's a lot of advice that you'll get from folks. You know, money should flow to the author, not away from the author. Vanity presses, thank God, are falling by the wayside and are a thing of the past. I hope. you know, people will complain about writer's block. Don't complain about writer's block. Writer's block is just a stoppage because you're not sure where to go next. Write something else. It'll come to you. Put the butt in the chair and write every day. If it's only 200 words or it's only 100 words, it's only 100 words. Write every day. Make sure that you are honing your craft. It's like playing an instrument or a career. You do it every day. After a certain number of hours, days, weeks, and months, you start becoming proficient in whatever craft it is. And that's my advice for a new writer. It's going to be hard work. It's work. It's not playtime. You see a lot of people complaining on social media about, oh, I haven't been able to write in 2 weeks. I haven't been feeling well. I get that. And sick days are allowed, et cetera. But, you know, you got to think about this as your job. This is something that you need to do if you really want to do it well. And you really should do it well if you're going to do it at all. That's my advice to people, right? You work at it and you work at it and talk to people who've been there and done that. 9 times out of 10, they'll talk to you. That 1 time out of 10, they'll tell you to piss off and why are you in my house, you know? But other than that, it's fine. I'm being funny for those of you who didn't realize it.
Oh man, I want to ask about the cover for this. This was designed by Kip Ayers, amazing talent. Big shout out to him. They did an amazing job with this. What was sort of the back and forth about coming up with a final version?
Okay, so Kip is a great artist to work with, especially if you're a writer, because he loves working with writers, and he's very collaborative. I found him, there was a, what was it called? It used to be called Elance. It was a, you know, a freelancer website where you could find artists. And he had some of his work on display, and he was reasonably priced. And when I put out Prodigal's Fool, it was with a small press that eventually went under, so I had to switch it over to an indie publication. But I wanted to spruce it up with a new cover. I found him via the Elance, and he did the cover for Prodigal's Fool. And I've worked with him on other covers and some ancillary work since then. I found his work to be impeccable. He is the consummate professional. He's just a good human being. When I got sick, he sent me a beautiful portrait of a golden eagle, which is a healing bird for Native American culture. And it's hanging right by my desk, because that was a gift that I never want to forget. And it just tells me that humanity is worth saving for the most part. So with Bayou Whispers, the cover conversation started this way. I've got a book. It's in New Orleans. It's called Bayou Whispers. I've got a cover idea. It starts off with a murder and then becomes a lot more than that. So we can kind of use an image from New Orleans, and then, you know, the murders, these two guys who needed to be killed anyway because they were very bad people. What do you want to do with that? And he took my vague, non-professional glob of words and turned it into a piece of art that is beautiful. I can't talk enough about what he's done. I wish I could show you, but I really can't. The next book that I'm working on, he did a cover. He just gave me a cover about a week ago for that, and it's better than the Bayou Whispers cover.
This cover is like poster worthy. I would love to like print this up, frame it, put it like on my wall, because it's such an awesome cover.
You mean like that?
Just like that, exactly. Just like that. Oh wow, yeah, but absolutely phenomenal job, because like, you know. It's weird because the old saying is don't judge a book by its cover, but you do. The cover is what sells the mm-hmm. book. Like, I have bought books strictly because the cover looked cool enough that I checked it out and said, okay, I'm buying this, but the cover is what drew me in. So I really feel like the cover needs to be professionally done. Don't.
You know, if you're an indie writer, as opposed to looking to go the traditional route, the two biggest pieces of advice I can give you is have a professional cover made for you, and have a professional editor edit your work.
For the love of God, yes to both of those, because I have read some books that they clearly do not have an editor, and I'm counting the mistakes.
Yeah, that just pulls somebody out of the story, and the last thing you want. The cover is supposed to be a visual grab so people read the blurb, and if you write the blurb properly, there's a good chance they'll pick the book up. If they've picked it up to look at the cover, they're going to read the blurb. And then when that happens, if you've done your job as a writer and the artist has done their job, you know, you got a good chance at a sale.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about release days, because certainly that has taken on a very different meaning in the here and now. Used to be when you published a book, you plan your signings, your readings, you would be part of the cons and the festivals. Obviously, not possible right now. How did you go about planning your release day? And as a follow-up question, what's your plan once things like, you know, expos and cons become a possibility?
All of those. Oh man, you just have all the good questions, man.
Thank you.
You should do this more. Sorry. I knew because of COVID and the timelines that were in place with getting vaccinations and where the drug, I was in the drug development business for a long time, biotech pharmaceutical industry as a technologist. And I know how long these things take. You know, it's amazing that we have three vaccinations now, vaccines available to us now. I mean, that was just unbelievably fast. You know, and you gotta thank the Orange Cheeto a little bit for that. Just poor execution on the logistics and everything else, which has been corrected, thank goodness. But I realized it was going to have to be an online event. And I have a dear friend of mine. His name is Joel Kaplan, and his wife, Dr. Rachel Geller, dear friends of my wife and mine. He runs a really good PR firm and marketing firm in Boston called MK3. And he offered up his team to help me with a live launch. So Facebook already has the infrastructure in there for a lot of people. So you work with that. And then he had a tool called vMix, which allowed us to put together a video of Todd, who's hosting it, and myself having the conversation. And then we'd split to go to readings and then do a Q&A, pretty much the same sort of thing that would happen at a launch event. You know, you'd have a launch. There'd be a little talk about the book and the setting and maybe some of the characters. There'd be a reading. There'd be some wine afterwards. There'd be a book signing, etc. In the age of COVID, and you can't do a lot of that stuff, so you have to make do with the tools that you have. For example, you know, they're calling the new generation that's coming up Zoomers as opposed to Boomers because of Zoom, and we're on it now, and it's been a godsend to get things done. Joe Maynard at Crystal Lake Publishing lives in South Africa. He and I could Zoom and have a conversation and settle things in 5 minutes. That's how, you know, the world is that large and that small. And that's made this whole process certainly better than it would have been had it been even 5 years ago. Moving forward, you know, I'm doing a lot of podcasts. I'm doing some traditional media. I did a television interview with Good Day Louisiana that was posted on May 3rd, and that's their CBS affiliate down there. And I just did a radio show in Boston. And those sort of remote opportunities exist. But I'm looking forward to actually getting out there. And I have, believe it or not, once I get my second vaccination, which is this weekend, after that, I'm speaking with an old professor of mine from Emerson College. He's got a book coming out this summer. And we're talking about if bookstores are really starting to book readings again and libraries and things along those lines, perhaps we'll do a dual and joint reading for his book and for Bayou Whispers to keep it there. You know, everything coming up to the launch is great. It's the follow on that you really need to sell the books, right? I don't have a name in the industry, right? It's as simple as that. You know, Stephen King writes a book and it could be literally blank pages. People will buy it because it has his name on it. you know, and there's a reason for that. He's a great storyteller and he is a prolific writer. I don't know how he writes so fast, but you know, it's all about getting the name of the book in the name of the author out there. I'm trying to do it the best I can during COVID by doing these podcasts and radio shows and TV shows. And, you know, the TV show was a Zoom meeting. The radio show was, I literally called into the radio show for that one. And then there was another one in Stony Brook, New York that I did. And that was Zoom, but Phil, who was the broadcaster, refused to put it on his camera because he was still in his pajamas. Sorry, Phil, I told a secret. But in the time of a pandemic, it gave me a lot of time to get the book right, work on my own physicality, which you know is something that's pretty important, you know, because I put on a boatload of weight at the beginning of the pandemic. I think a lot of us put on the COVID-15, as they say. And you know, I'm easing into the whole live event piece. And for me personally, I think it was the right way to do it. I don't know if I would have been ready when the book launched to have this massive presence in a bookstore with 35, 40, 50, 100, whatever number of people showing up or not showing up, as the case may be. You know, the Facebook online, the launch event, we had probably 50 or 60 people there, which is respectable. But I know for a fact the video has had 800 viewings since then. That's huge. And that may translate to sales. We'll have to see at the end of the quarter. I went off on tangents there, man. I'm sorry.
No, it's cool. Hey, dude, it's totally okay, man. I'm going to shift gears now because there's something else that I want to touch on briefly, and that is the Word Count podcast. This is something that you started a decade ago. Yep. Writers are asked to record their own short stories and submit that to you, and they're played as part of the show. And you did this for 10 years, ended it last November. How did you get to ending it? Was it kind of a gradual thing that you felt it was slowing down, or was it an aha moment? You said, okay, pulling the plug.
The last 18 months of the Word Count podcast, I wasn't getting a lot of new writers contributing to it. I was getting, fortunately, the same old storytellers who I used to call the Word Count irregulars are fabulous. You know, the Bill Curtins and the Eden Baileys of the world, just fabulous people and talented writers. And it got to a point where I wasn't loving it anymore. It was the same old, and I just said, you know what? I'm coming up to episode 100. That's a nice round number. I think I'll call it there. I mean, the show was basically, I would create a prompt. People would write a 7-minute story, which is about, depending on how fast they read, 800 words, a flash piece of fiction, and they would read it. And everyone who participated for any length of time in the show said it helped with their own writing careers just because they learned to read properly. It also helped with their editing process, because I tell everyone that if you read your story out loud, you'll hear things that your eyes won't pick up. And it's yet another nugget of wisdom from old man Dr. Wood. But I think the podcast itself had run its course. I wasn't getting new writers in. Listenership was staying about the same. And I just wasn't getting the sales from the book. From books and short stories that I would hope would come of that. I met some great people and some great friends, but it was time to move on. I have other things I want to focus on. You'll notice I still have the microphone set up on the desk. I'm not adverse to doing another show at some point or participating in another podcast at some point. I had some ideas about doing like a 1930s radio type show, except the show would be a part of the podcast and then the after part would be part of the podcast. But I started talking with a few actors and things like that, but it's not holding my interest either. So, you know, an idea needs to come up for me to jump back in, and I'd love to do that at some point, but I haven't heard one yet. If there's an idea that you have, throw it out there, man. I'll listen.
Oh, I probably got a few.
Excellent.
Now, when you first started WordCount, was it hard to get writers? Like, how did you find the writers that you came to work with?
Believe it or not, I found all of them via social media. I was a member of new writer groups and things along those lines, you know, when there's a bunch of people just starting out, et cetera. And some older folks as well who were switching careers to writing and or retired and were writing. And I said, hey, I have this idea. You know, there are a lot of writing podcasts out there talking about the craft or talking about specific genres and things along those lines. What if we did a show that had different stories each week? The writers retain the rights to the story. You know, you just give me written permission to use the story in the show and we'll go from there. I got people showing up for the first couple of podcasts. I will tell you the first two podcasts were more like those older shows. You know, I was interviewing some writers and people behind the scenes. And then I did a Halloween special for the third show. Then I said, hey, submit your stories. And I had 8 people submit their stories to me. And it was one of the best hot rated shows that year. And I went, you know what? This is my format. So I can change, but the show hadn't changed in a long time. And I don't know what I would have changed it to. And quite frankly, I want to do something else.
Fair enough. Yeah. This is probably a tricky question, but any writer or story that kind of sticks in your head?
Oh, I did it. I did a show for Mercedes Yardley, who's a Bram Stoker award-winning horror writer. And I did an interview with her. I think it was around episode 30 or so. And it was the funniest conversation I had because she read a bit of her novella that had come out. But at the end of it, I put in a whole bunch of outtakes because we just laughed through the entire thing. And it was one of my favorite shows to produce just because I dealt with one person. She had her reading, but we also did an interview as a part of it. And she's just such a delightful, delightful, kind person that it was just a pleasure to do that show. That's probably my favorite of all of them.
Any podcasts that you're listening to right now that you would like to kind of like give a shout out to, recommend to the listeners?
I was until he stopped it listening to Brian Keene's podcast, of course, and that's now gone by the wayside. Eating the Fantastic by Scott Edelman is a fun podcast. He interviews writers and he's got some pretty famous people on his show. And he basically takes them to lunch. They go someplace or they go out for donuts. So they eat someplace because he's a big foodie. And they talk and they talk about genre and they talk about the business and they talk about people that they knew. And it's like two friends catching up and you're eavesdropping on it. And it's just a fun show. Some of them go very long, an hour, hour and a half and things like that. But they're fun to listen to. I haven't not liked one of them. And that's what I'm listening to currently.
Well, RB, man, this has been an amazing time. I've loved talking to you. Definitely checking out the rest of the book. For the folks at home, Bayou Whispers, now available. Go to rbwood.com for more information. Do get your copies. Follow him on the socials. Check out the Word Count podcast. It's still available. And I definitely look forward to the next time we talk.
Anytime, man. This is great fun. I didn't even realize it, an hour had passed already.
That is a good sign.
A pleasure talking with you, and I look forward to doing it again soon, man.
Hi, this is singer Kate Eppers, and you're listening to Citywide Blackout.
All right, folks, that brings this episode to a close. You can follow the show on Facebook under Citywide Blackout and Twitter and Instagram under Citywide Max. Listen to the show on Podbean, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Amazon Music, and every Saturday at 10 p.m. on Boston Free Radio. As always, keep those ears open.